Hello, I'm Ross Camage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs, of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today, among other things, is going to help us get into the world of regulatory science space. And so I'm very excited to have as our guest, Jean-Fourie Zuckelbach. Jean, would you care to introduce yourself in any way that you see fit?
Thank you, Ross. I could start by saying that I am a passionate mom of two 11 and 14-year-old boys. And I'm also, I would say, an encouraging wife to an extremely energetic and adventurous husband who often throws either small or big adventures our way and see how we handle them. And I think he probably enjoys those adventures more than even my boys do.
Because men never grow up, you know that, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's like having a third child in the house. Yeah. Just to give you a taste, like our adventures usually is outdoors and as a checkbox, you need extreme weather conditions.
And then go on, you actually have a job as well, though, in addition to all of those other roles.
I do. So professionally, I'm a clinical pharmacologist. I work at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in the Division of Cancer Pharmacology, where it is our mission to apply clinical pharmacology principles to allow for or promote therapeutic individualization. And that really means just finding the right dosage of cancer medications for the right patients before they're approved.
Great. And you actually have a fancy title. You're called a master pharmacokineticist, which is strangely sexist in a way.
Yes. It's a new title that they came up with, and it just allows one to actually do the regulatory science and what the government pays you to do mostly, in addition to any research interests that you want to pursue. So my research interests that I'd like to pursue as part of my job is aimed and inspired to include complementary data on patient voice or patient experience as they take cancer medications, and then including those data in our toolbox that we use to find the right dose for those specific cancer patients.
So we're going to dig into that later, but let's start off by what a pharmacokineticist is, or how do you become one?
A clinical pharmacologist, they look at how drugs behave in the body, where they bind, how they get to their receptors that they're promoting their clinical activity at. And we also look at how the body breaks down the drug, or how what happens to the drug once you ingest it. How does it distribute? Where does it go? Does it reach its target? Does it break down? Does it stay intact? Where does it break down? And then how it gets eliminated, how long it stays in the body, how short it stays in the body, and really looking at sort of the efficacy or the benefit of that drug, as well as the toxicity of that drug in cancer medicine. So finding that right dose where, or that window where efficacy is optimized or the best that you can get while maintaining a lower toxicity threshold, so not exposing patients to high toxicities that they just can't tolerate. I think we use a lot of tools, quantitative tools, in order to do this, in order to kind of use all of the data that we have from chemistry, other disciplines, clinical, pharm tox, pharmacology, toxicology, and then modeling all of these data together in order to determine what is the right dose for this type of patient.
I always feel like pharmacokinetics, they are the like the data gurus. You know, they're not kind of like too much qualitative stuff, although we'll get into the patient voice. But I mean, did you have like a science upbringing? Were your parents scientists? I mean, it's a very specific thing to go into at an early age.
My mom worked in industry in the pharmaceutical sciences, and actually that was how she got the opportunity for us to move from South Africa, where I grew up as a child to Canada. So she has always been very driven person, very scientific. And so I think I was influenced from an early age with an interest in science from just my mom. And then my dad is also very observant. He's a geologist. So, you know, he also dabbles in the earth sciences from that aspect.
Yeah, so it's a good kind of, you know, science kind of upbringing. Whereabouts in South Africa did you grow up?
I grew up in Pretoria, which is in the central part of South Africa.
Like the boring administrative center? Is that Pretoria?
Yeah, it's kind of the capital city.
Not as bad. What's the place which is really the administrative capital? Bloemfontein.
No, I would say the administrative capital is Pretoria. There's a lot of business there. Johannesburg is sort of the engine driving that money markets and the business aspects of South Africa. And then Cape Town is the other big city that is a beautiful city where tourism and wine culture, wineries, and just tourism is a big factor in the economy there.
Yeah, I love Cape Town. I worked in South Africa, actually in KwaZulu-Natal when I was at the end of my medical student training. So how old were you when you got to Canada? Which part of Canada? Where did you just like, okay, let's go from one end of the earth to the other?
Yeah, we landed in Toronto, Ontario, which is a large city, and we lived in the suburbs of Toronto. I think the experience of moving to Canada was kind of, you know, one of the first adverse events or kind of shape you as a person.
How did you grade that adverse event?
It was challenging, definitely landing in a new place, an eighth grade, knowing you've already made all your friends, you left them all behind.
And with a South African accent?
Actually, English is not my first language. So I was struggling to verbalize myself a lot because all my English was in my brain. I always just read it or listened to it, but I never really spoke English. So that was a challenge. Also, I think trying to make friends when you stick out like a sore thumb is challenging. I had a South African wardrobe that was extreme.
I never thought about that.
I wore dresses, you know, with flowers and bright colors. And then I come here and people don't wear dresses because it's too cold half the year to wear dresses. And kids are kind of in these subdued black or gray clothing. And so it is a little bit hard to not get bullied and to make good friends when you're coming to a new country. And also, you know, we didn't have a lot of money when we first came. So we were living the immigrant experience.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. You said English isn't your first language. So of your very exciting last name, what's the derivation?
Boré is the South African portion of it. And then my husband is German ancestry. He's actually from California. So the Zirkelbach is from there.
But what was your first language?
My first language is similar to Dutch. It's called Afrikaans. It's not very well-known language, but it's if someone speaks Dutch, I can completely converse with them. So similar to Dutch. So
wow,
the cool thing about it. A lot of South Africans actually immigrate to Holland.
We're in Toronto. You're 12 years old, struggling with all of the fun of being 12 years old in a different country. And then we can fast forward, but then I still want to know how kind of like a 12-year-old goes, yes, toxicology, that's what I want to do as a degree. Were you planning on poisoning people? Was that the getting revenge on all the people who bullied you?
I started to notice my stubbornness in science and not willing to give up on experiments from, you know, I have a story about when I was in ninth grade where it was spring break and my parents wanted to take us on a road trip to Florida. But I had a fruit fly experiment. We're looking at breeding different types of fruit flies and studying Mendelian genetics for a ninth grade project. And I really didn't want to go on this trip. And I told them so. And they said, well, you're going, but you cannot take your fruit flies with you because We're landed immigrants, and we don't want any trouble by moving insects across the border. So I took things in my own hands. I noticed that if I were to place my fruit flies under my armpits in tubes that they came in, I would be able to incubate them at the right temperature. And so I smuggled my fruit flies across the border and did my experiment in our car and in our road trip to Florida. So
I think if people could see me, my jaw is now on the floor at this point.
I think that kind of was my first remembrance of doing science experiments and really enjoying it.
That's pretty cool.
And then toxicology is the extension of pharmacology. It's the worst case scenario. It's looking at how carcinogens or cancer-causing drugs are processed in the body, how they actually form molecules that can attack the DNA and cause tumors. And these chemicals can stem from environmental carcinogens all the way to recreational drugs that people take and clinical drugs that people take, like, psychopharmacology, how these drugs act on the brain and cause the therapeutic effect versus the effects that are not so pleasant.
And you did the toxicology degree at University of Toronto. At that point in time, were you just enjoying it, or was there an idea that it was going to lead to something? I mean, did you have a path ahead of you?
I didn't really have a path ahead of me. I knew that I enjoyed working with people through my volunteer work and things in hospitals and working with the elderly. So I wanted to get into clinical aspects of pharmacology. And the next step that I sought was to do a master's degree also at the University of Toronto in psychopharmacology, where we look at metabolism, drugs used in schizophrenia or drugs used in depression, and how metabolism of these drugs differ between certain genetic populations and how that affects the efficacy or the toxicity of the drugs. That was the first taste of working with patients and really understanding that patients who have mental disease have something to say. They are not just, a patient, but they are very interesting once you get to know them, and they have contributions on, how they got there. And I just find that interaction with people with maybe voices that are not heard often in society or kind of muted in society, it really gives you a nice perspective on life and trying to put your perspective in other people's view of how they see things.
I love that. And then did the master's lead into the PhD, or was that's a separate decision?
That was a separate decision. I wanted to get a little bit more experience in molecular pharmacology, so more lab experience to kind of complement my clinical knowledge, clinical pharmacology experience. And so I went to the Winnipeg, which is in the western part of Canada, extremely cold winters, like minus 30.
Yeah, it makes Toronto look warm. Yeah.
I became a true Canadian there. We played ice hockey outside and all kinds of things that I never thought I would do. Yeah, so I did my PhD at the University of Manitoba, looking at different structures of molecules and how they affect the activity of that molecule. So more of a chemistry-based type of science.
How long did your PhD last? Most people experience the extremes of highs and lows during a PhD.
Yeah, it was 6 years. I actually had a $12,000 stipend, which made me kind of living in the poverty line. I enjoyed that, actually. I lived in the inner city where a lot of native Canadians live, a lot of people on the poverty line live, and I didn't have a car. So I really got to know my neighbors. I got to know the people who I've never thought that I would be able to interact with. And I really got a taste of, a better taste of sort of understanding people again, looking at, you know, how you feel in your environment and how that shapes you. So that was very interesting experience. I went to their same grocery stores as a lot of people struggling economically went. I remember vividly being approached by someone on the bus. They were trying to sell me a piece of steak that they had bought earlier at a discount price. I remember being asked to buy some shoes on the street. I remember seeing kids sniffing glue in the corners, you know, the struggles with drug addiction, and young mothers, you know, not being able to afford a jug of milk and rather buying, you know, you see a lot of these large bottles of soda that they're trying to feed their children with. So really eye-opening and humbling experience.
Yeah, I bet. This is one of my favorite stories that you told me, is you then decided from the frozen north that the next step in your career was to go to, like, I mean, you do like to go to the extreme, like, you know, South Africa to Canada. So you're like, where's the furthest away point on this landmass that I can go to for my postdoc? So tell us that story and how you got there.
Well, it was the classic Canadian brain drain, where there's not a lot of jobs or opportunities in Canada for the highly trained scientists that they create. And so I got the opportunity to move to University of Alabama, Birmingham, and work with the cancer center director there, Dr. Robert Diazio. And we looked at certain cancer molecules that are approved and how patients are predisposed to adverse events just based on their genetic metabolism or the way that they process these drugs. So that was another kind of clinical pharmacology plus molecular biology interchange, where everything kind of dovetailed into one project. I think the funny part about it was that I think you maybe remember, is that I never drove a car before. And so before I left in Winnipeg, I remember taking the bus on a very cold day, my winter jackets on, slugging through the thick snow, going to a car dealership and buying the cheapest car that I could find, which, unfortunate for me, was a stick shift Chevy Cavalier. And I struggled for the next week moving from the north border of the U.S. all the way to Birmingham, Alabama, learning stick shift and really testing my abilities to survive.
I'm hoping that by the time you arrived in Alabama, that you could actually drive the car.
I don't know if you've been to Birmingham. It's extremely hilly. It's like up and down like this. Oh, so goodness. It was extremely good practice. And I think I can still kill it if I were to have added at your car, for instance.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, when we were chatting, I drive a stick shift too in a beaten up old Subaru. And so we were bonding over that. Yeah, I feel like the Alabama is like, that's the confluence of all these things, you know, the toxicology, the pharmacology, the patient voice, or at least the patient experience. And then suddenly you're in cancer and you're working on cancer drugs. I think you're working on 5-FU, which is a chemotherapy.
Yes.
Okay, this is the point in one's life where you kind of go, okay, so I'm going to run a lab or I'm going to do something else, you know, kicking the life decisions down the road. But in Alabama, you get to a fork in the road, don't you?
I do. It's very challenging to be a scientist in the academic sense. You know, there's a lot of hard work involved in getting grants and managing a lab. And it's really extreme full-time occupation. I think, you know, life kind of has to take a back step, and you really have to, once you start a lab, just focus on that. And I wasn't sure whether at that age, you know, I've already spent like 12 years in school. I felt like I needed something that's going to make me happy earlier rather than later. And so I did another postdoc at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, which was really my opportunity to interact more with physicians, clinicians, and have the opportunity to speak to someone from the office where I work right now. He used to be my boss, Dr. Brian Booth, and he said I should apply to the Office of Clinical Pharmacology. It is actually the largest group of clinical pharmacologists in the world. It's got such a high reputation for just excellence in quantitative modeling. And so I was really fortunate to start a position there after my second postdoc and start as a Yale reviewer, beginner reviewer, and then work my way up to where I am now.
So do you remember how you bumped into them? Were you like, how did the conversation start?
At a conference, I was presenting a poster and he came to my poster and we just chatted. He's actually Canadian himself. And he saw my name and he thought I was speaking French, but you know, my French is very basic because actually in Canada, they gave me a pass on studying advanced French. I was able to study basic French and he was a little disappointed. And I think still today he tries his French to me and, you know, I have to study my very basic French and keep that a little bit outdated just to have a simple conversation with him make him appreciate that he hired me.
So I can speak a little French, but the funny thing is that the only people with a worse French accent than me are the French Canadians.
Oh, don't tell that to Brian. He's French.
All right. So 2008, I think, is when you made the shift and you joined the Office of Clinical Pharmacology, which for those not familiar, that's part of the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. And I have to say, from the outside, the divisions and departments do seem like a labyrinth at the FDA. Is there any way you can just give us a kind of thumbnail sketch of what divisions and departments and all that sort of means in there?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Everybody says it's a black box, but we work in CDER.
Which stands for?
The Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. And so we, within that large center, we have smaller groups. We have the OCE, the Oncology Center for Excellence, which is led by Dr. Rick Pastor. And all the clinicians in oncology are housed there. Then we have different offices in statistics, different disciplines that actually have to interact with the clinicians in order to review all the aspects of drugs. So we have chemistry, we have pharmacology, toxicology, which deal with the animal studies that are done prior to clinical studies. And then we have the clinical pharmacologist, which translate or explain a lot of these more basic science disciplines to the clinicians. So our bread and butter is really dose. We love to optimize the dose. We love to identify what factors cause variability in concentrations of drugs and how we can optimize those concentrations to get the best efficacy and maintain safe or less adverse reactions for patients with cancer. So yeah, it's really a multidisciplinary team. We get together for every meeting. All of those groups get together. We discuss the whole molecule from chemistry to clinical, and we deal with all of the issues that the pharmaceutical sponsor may have, the questions they may have, and we try to answer those using kind of a holistic approach and getting input from everybody. So it's a very collaborative environment, and I think that's what makes it so exciting to do research there, because my interests in patient voice are really only fueled by interactions with the clinical group. So that I can kind of dovetail what is clinical pharmacology to what is important for clinicians in terms of assessing the risk benefit of drugs. So it's a large conglomerate of different groups, but it is a very exciting place to work. Every day something new, every day a challenge, every day interaction with different people and just trying to do your best.
I saw in your CV, so two things that stood out. The first thing is to explain that you're not doing the analyses on these, you know, blood samples or pharmacokinetics. You're taking the data generated by a drug company. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is just the scale. I think you said you're looking at something like 100 different products a year.
Yes. In oncology, it's a very busy therapeutic area. We have 30 reviewers just in clinical pharmacology and oncology. So each of those reviewers would review, say, 100 submissions. So in the end of the year, we have thousands of drugs that we have touched, looking just from the initiation of clinical studies, so the first in human study, all the way up to approval, and all of those studies that are needed in order to approve a safe and effective drug. It is extremely busy. Also, our excellent reviewers that we have often get poached by industry. So we're constantly trying to catch up and hire new people. I think we train really excellent scientists in our group that are sought off there by a lot of industry.
Let's say I'm a drug company and I come up with, you know, Wonder Drug X. How early in the development of that drug, you know, just in animals or in people, do I interact with you?
You would interact too with me at the first in human study when you submit your protocol for that first in human clinical study where you've already done some of your animal work. You've seen how the drug works, where it works, what molecular targeted it has. Me in oncology now, it's just molecularly targeted drugs. So which receptor does it bind to? Which pathway does it block? And then we look at sort of the first study, which aims at dose finding. So increasing the dose of the drug gradually in small subsets of patients, and then identifying dosages that you want to move forward with in larger patient groups after you see some activity. So you want to make sure that you look at the safety initially by increasing the dosage, finding dosages that are tolerable to patients, and then expanding a little bit in those cohorts of patients so that you can see if there is any activity. Initial activity, such as overall response rates, that's common primary endpoint for these early studies. And then tolerability is another thing that one can assess. So longer-term toxicity or adverse reactions, as they occur when you take the drug for more than just that short period where you're escalating the dose. So there's like a first part where dose escalation, and then there's like dose expansion, where you're looking at more the activity, the longer-term tolerability, and getting those data that clinical pharmacologists like to review in terms of exposure or concentrations of the drug and efficacy, exposure and toxicity, and finding those windows where efficacy may be optimized, but then there's a lot of other studies that need to be done. Phase two, larger efficacy trials, and then all of the clinical pharmacology studies that need to be done. Should your drug be taken with food? Does the drug dose change when one has liver disease because the drug gets cleared through the liver, for instance? I mean, there are lots of clinical pharmacology aspects that need to occur during that drug development phase before we get the package that the sponsor would like to approve.
So one of the tensions, so I these things sort of cross my desk in a different way, you know, in terms of should I take it on for my patients, you know, multiple times a week. But one of the things that there's tension is, you know, the perfect clinical pharmacokinetic study would have so many blood samples over so many hours and multiple days to get a complete data set. Whereas, you know, to go back to your people on the bus in Manitoba, is there's still a person there who says, well, I don't want to come in at 3 o'clock in the morning just so you can get a data point. So there's always that tension about, you know, more data versus, you know, disruption to the patient. So how do you square that circle?
Well, we have tools to deal with that. So initially for these early studies is where we really characterize the PK, but with dense sampling, as you say, you know, they have to have some dense sampling, but the data sets for those are typically small. They range anywhere from 4 to 6 to 8 patients per dose level. So patients are typically in these studies, they are in the clinic or they are being hospitalized. And so the PK samples can ideally occur during this time. But then later on, when patients want to go home or they don't want to come to the clinic for an IV infusion, they want to take the drug orally, you know, they don't want to come in for a PK sample, like you said, or a pharmacokinetics blood sample. So we have tools such as collecting sparse sampling. And so you would maybe collect one sample from a patient at this point, another sample from a patient at this time point, and you combine all those data from hundreds of patients in order to come up with a profile that you can use in order to say, well, you know, the efficacy is really optimum at this dosage. Here is the curve showing the different concentrations and how efficacy changes or how it stays flat. And these are the range of concentrations where people start getting maybe grade 3 diarrhea. So we do want to stay away from that. So model-informed drug development is really a tool in clinical pharmacology that we can use to benefit patients in terms of the time that they need to spend giving, you know, precious time that they have to give samples and really further the development of that drug.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a study cross my desk yesterday, I think, and the drug was intravenous. It was given once every 3 weeks, but they wanted the patient to come into the clinic every day for the first 3 days and then every week for 9 weeks. And you go, well, what if I live, you know, a 3-hour flight away? I mean, how are you supposed to do that?
Yeah, so we have other tools for that. You can send in dry blood sampling. You can just get put your blood on a, looks like a little piece of paper, and you can actually analyze the blood that way. There are decentralized ways to do clinical trials. FDA has the Oncology Center of Excellence has specific motivations and projects in order to advance those initiatives that allow patients in remote areas to also participate in clinical trials. So patients that may be underrepresented. So there are definitely initiatives being taken to address those issues. But you're right. It's not possible for a patient, especially when they're trying to just focus on being strong and having all these other problems that come associated with a diagnosis of cancer and expecting them to travel far distances for data points that they may not see a benefit in for themselves.
It's funny. I think we might be on the same side here, because I sometimes feel like we're the advocate for the patient to kind of sometimes push back on these things and say, look, you don't need that much data. There are other ways. And, you know, let's put the patient back at the center of the decision making.
Definitely. No, I definitely agree with that. Clinical pharmacology has a range of tools that industry can use in order to minimize the burden on patients.
Okay, I've got a challenging question here, you. So one of the central tenets of pharmacokinetics is that outcomes, you know, be they toxicity or efficacy, are related to blood concentrations. I mean, that's it. That's, you know, the central tenet. But what happens if your drug whizzes into the tissues and then binds there? Well, what happens if the area where you're talking about, let's say, is the brain, where there might be a different concentration to the blood? So is that just like, we know it's an issue, but we don't know what to do about it? Or has our science evolved in that regard?
one can measure drug concentrations over time, so one can actually see how the drugs gets cleared. One can also, instead of measure, so pharmacokinetics, like you said, is a surrogate for efficacy. When we have concentrations, we can deduce efficacy. But if you look at what happens in the tumor, you can also assess how that pharmacodynamics changes due to the drug binding there. So if you have a drug that actually goes to the target, you will see downstream changes in the signaling pathway. And one can measure those they're called pharmacodynamic endpoints, and correlate those again with efficacy, how the tumor shrinks or how the tumor does not shrink, or you can correlate it with safety. So there are other more complementary ways in order to get a full picture of what happens to that drug. So one can use pharmacokinetics, you use the clinical data, the endpoints, you can use the non-clinical data. You've mentioned the tumor models that may show brain penetration of certain drugs. You can get clinical data with patients, for instance, that have metastases to the brain and see the shrinkage of the tumor, for instance. And the way that we can optimize the dose when it's difficult to get the drug to the brain is really to look at the non-clinical data. So seeing what concentrations of my drug are needed to bind to the receptor or the target at optimum concentrations. So what concentration is needed for my drug to bind 90% of the time to that receptor? And if we have these preclinical models, we can kind of use them in order to say, well, systemically in the body, these concentrations are going to work on tumors that are outside of the brain. But in order to penetrate the brain, we need higher concentrations of the drug in order to reach their target. And so one can make arguments on the dosage that is needed for CNS penetration, providing that the molecule does actually cross the blood-brain barrier or cross into the brain, in order to optimize dosage for those specific tumors. And the way that we can also assess how the concentrations are changed in the brain is to look at the CSF fluid. Those are more invasive procedures, but again, they are done in first-in-human trials where we get consent from patients in order to get these valuable data points that actually show that the drug is penetrating, and we can use these data then combined with the clinical efficacy data to support, for instance, a higher dosage for patients with brain metastases versus patients with lung cancer, just local lung cancer.
I think that's an interesting area that's being explored. The other one, which was the first part of my question, I did a lot of research on EGFR inhibitors back in the day, and when they first developed irreversible inhibitors, so not just stuff that goes on binds to the receptor and comes off again, but binds there and literally forms a covalent bond with it, everyone was freaking out because they didn't know how to deal with, you know, the levels in the blood, because maybe that didn't matter if it wasn't in the blood because it had all bound to the receptor in the tissue. And I don't know that we ever resolved that. I still think we go back to the blood levels, even for irreversible inhibitors.
There aren't a lot of irreversible inhibitors that are being developed currently. It's usually an on-off situation where there's like this dynamic dance with the drug molecule in the receptor. And so pharmacokinetics really is a good tool for that. And then if there is covalent binding to a target inside a tumor, one is able to potentially get a biopsy and look at the concentrations of that drug actually in the tumor or in a longer time frame.
Well, actually, two things. So the first thing is, so you were at the FDA when you had your two sons. Is that right? Are they a good employer if you're going to have babies?
I Yeah, I think I had 3 months of maternity leave, and now I think they have parental leave, so the mom and the dad can take parental leave if you are having a new child. It all depends on the group you work with. My group is such a big family. We support each other in almost every aspect. If you can do something, you're definitely going to get help to do it. So there's always someone willing to step up and take over your responsibilities if you have family obligations. So it's definitely a really nice group that I'm working with at the Division of Cancer Pharmacology.
I can hear it in your voice, just how much you love that group.
That's like paper makes me sting.
Yeah. All right. So we've got to get to, you know, one of the latest things which you're an author on, which is Project Optimus. This is like pharmacokinetics being invited to the ball. It's like this is, you know, front and center. So can we try and explain to the audience what Project Optimus is?
Yes, I can explain it in a simple way, which is previously in oncology, we approved drugs that are mostly cytotoxic. So they are given for short periods of time, chemotherapy, and one needs a high concentration in order for the cell killing to occur inside the tumor. But now in oncology, we are developing molecularly targeted agents. The problem is that we use that maximum tolerated dose paradigm that we use for cancer chemotherapy in molecularly targeted agents, which is not appropriate. And the reason is that we don't need super high concentrations of the drug in order to have efficacy. All we need to do is allow for maximum target occupancy. So the drug concentrations just need to bind to that target at that therapeutic range in order to be efficacious. When that's not, you need any higher concentrations. And that is the problem, that we were using this old paradigm to develop new drugs. So Project Optimus is designed to really modernize oncology dose selection by looking at the concentrations or optimizing the dosage by looking at different aspects, not just how much you can pump into the patient, but looking at the science of it, looking at receptor occupancy, the preclinical data, the clinical data, the modeling approaches, using clinical pharmacology approaches or tools to find that sweet spot of where therapeutic efficacy is optimized and toxicity is limiting or limited. So Project Optimus has really evolved to change clinical trials in order that these data are collected early on, so that one has a nice data set or data package that includes all of these different aspects, and then select dosages that you want to move forward with in a more scientific approach rather than the previous and to or accident tolerated dose approach. But that's really what Project Optimus is trying to do, is modernize clinical trials to optimize the dosage so that patients can actually take a drug and that drug can be tolerated well, because if you give it too high a concentration or dose of that drug, people are not going to be able to stay on it and get the maximum efficacy. They're going to go off it. They're going to go on it. They're going to decrease their dose. They're going to say, oh, I can't take this drug anymore because look at me. I'm sitting at home having 4 episodes of diarrhea a day, and I just can't function with my basic daily activities. I can't go to the store. I mean, can you just like put yourself in that situation and see, you know, how can I have a benefit when my tumor might be treated, but I'm having a horrible life? And the director of of the Oncology Center of Excellence always says, you know, or frequently remarks that if you leave the patient in the morning and they're sitting in the same chair that evening, you do not have a useful or effective therapy. What you have is something that may be treating the tumor, but the implications for or consequences in quality of life are just not worth it for patients. We're trying to change that and make the patient experience more integral part in dosage optimization. So looking at patient voice data, looking at patient reported outcomes, how patients experience these drugs is another part of Project Optimus. So it's really very modern and hopeful time for cancer patients, I think, because these ideas or tools are now being implemented in oncology trials, and they'll be reading out in the next few years, and we can actually hopefully see that we are approving drugs that are much more patient-friendly and more tolerable, yet very efficacious, because now patients can stay on them longer and get that full benefit.
I love it. So one thing is, I can imagine there's a learning curve. Okay, so in an ideal world, this goes on at that very early discussion. I'm starting the development of the drug, and I really want to generate that kind of data early on to make an informed, as you say, scientific decision. The issue is twofold. So one is, what happens if my drug is already way in development, and so we do a kind of retrofit, I think is the term I've heard Rick use. And then the other one is, if I do it early, how big does my data set have to be to say that decision is robust?
Yes. That is our questions that we grapple with every day.
Well, at least that. Okay. So.
There are unfortunately drugs who are caught in the middle of Project Optimus and they don't feel it's fair. We have a lot of expertise in our office that really analyze the data and ask pertinent questions on the dosage. So in those later phase development trials that are now being seen, you know, we often will tell sponsors that, you know, we have these remaining questions on the dosage that may challenge us in determining that this is the optimized dosage. So can you include smaller cohorts of patients where, for instance, you randomize to these two dose levels as your clinical trial is being done, or before the phase three part of your clinical trial where you're randomizing to the therapy standard? Can you include a design like that where we can say, okay, you have 50 patients at this dose, 50 patients at the other dose? As just an example, it depends really on the drug and what the characteristics of the drug on the sample size. But
no one is taking this as, you know, gospel here, so don't worry.
Looking at early endpoints and doing sort of an interim analysis to see, oh, you know, the safety of this drug is much better now that we have a lower concentrations of the drug, yet we are maintaining the efficacy. And so we can kind of stop that randomized design, because it's actually, randomized design is really good data. It's like everybody is controlled and you can really see just the differences due to the drug concentrations of two different doses. So that's why we prefer randomized dose design, to look at different dose levels and then have the data or the support really to move forward with one dosage for your trial that is going to support an approval.
So are you okay, it goes back to the kind of sample size, are you okay with like consistent trends in one way, or do they have to be, I'm not a statistician, but significant in some manner?
These are comparisons that do not need statistical rigor. So they involve looking at, for instance, efficacy rates, looking at the confidence intervals of those rates. Do they overlap? Is one dosage showing better efficacy than the other? Looking at dose levels in terms of grade of toxicity. how many patients at this dose have grade 1, for instance, diarrhea, how many patients are stopping their drug and then continuing on. So looking at differences in dose intensity. So these are all data that one can get if you have data comparing two dosages or more than two dosages in the clinical arena. So looking at efficacy and safety over the long term.
So is it, I just want to clarify. So is it that there's just enough data points from different angles that are all pointing in the same direction, even if each one is not individually statistically robust? You know, that's enough. Or is it just the simple thing that you go, sure, it's a trend, and maybe statistically we'll be wrong one in 20 times, but that's better than nothing, and we had nothing before.
Yes, it's supporting the dosage that you want to move forward with. So if you have support, we can, in clinical pharmacology, we can take all the different dosages from different studies and combine all those data in order to get a nice profile of the efficacy over different dose ranges. So we can use all of these small data sets and combine them as long as they're, you know, in the applicable patient population and really have a multifaceted approach to justifying the dosage. So none of the data are really looked at in isolation, but it's more of a global assessment looking at all of the different aspects and using our tools in order to optimize drug development in those later stages and also in the earlier stages where one really has no idea of what should be the dose to move forward with.
This would be a good time to bring in your research on the patient voice, the patient reported outcomes, because it's actually a personal interest of mine that our means of quantifying toxicity is not quite fit for purpose. Because again, when you put the patient at the center of it, the patient doesn't understand grade 1 and grade 2 or whatever. They want a much more simple thing. They want to know, like, in 6 months' time, can I, you know, go on vacation? Can I, you know, go skiing? And at least in a certain population of my lung cancer patients, it's, can I have a baby? I mean, it's, you know, that we're redefining what it means to have stage 4 cancer. And so I love the idea that you're bringing in that voice. So tell me a little bit about that.
As we've talked about, we have standard methods or modeling approaches that really use clinician assessed outcomes in terms of toxicity. So a patient with in a clinical trial go in and the physician or the caregiver would ask a specific questions, you know, how have you been doing on the drug? It might not be systemically or systematically answered questions. It really depends on the physician. And then they're kind of, if the patient says, well, I've had diarrhea, then you kind of have to work back and see, well, you know, what is the grade and how can I assess the toxicity? But if one allows sort of patient-reported outcome data in clinical trials, you are able to get a more immediate picture of how that patient is functioning on the drug, because the patient-reported outcome data measures as specific questions in a rigorous manner. So once a week, for instance, ask the same questions over and over, and you can assess how that patient is feeling on the drug, how much the toxicity interferes with their daily living. So there are specific questions that some of these instruments, like the one developed by the NCI, assess. And they really help us get data that we've never had before. So tolerability data, which one would not get with just clinical assessment at regular 6 weeks, for instance, intervals, but rather one gets a time course of these assessments on a specific adverse event or reaction to a drug that we may be interested in. Say it's diarrhea. Patients don't know how to assess diarrhea, right? But they can tell you how many loose or watery stools they had in that week, on that day, and how much it interfered with their daily living. So these questionnaires are actually designed to specifically assess the effects or the adverse events that affect quality of life and measure those differences over time. So we have some continuous kind of slow of patients, for instance, on their loosened watery stools. Does it go up at the start of the therapy? Does it go down? Do patients develop tolerance to it? And so all of these aspects can be included in our toolbox for clinical pharmacology. We can use the same tools, but now we're just including tolerability data, which we've never had before, into our analyses. And we've done a pilot study just looking at that, comparing regular assessment of toxicity or adverse events due to a drug compared to including patient-reported outcomes plus our standard methods of assessing toxicity that includes clinician-reported adverse events. And then we can see that even if the sample size or the of that group that had patient-reported outcome data plus standard clinical assessments, those data are much more sensitive to detect adverse events and how they change with drug concentrations versus just the standard ways that we used to assess exposure response or concentrations where toxicity may become a problem. So we have some tools by including patient-reported outcome data that we can really use in order to sensitively assess dosages early on in development using much smaller data sets, but actually getting brand new data on tolerability that we've never been able to include.
I think that's amazing. There's a joke going around the patient community, at least in lung cancer, of the physicians using words like tolerable when they're not the one going through it. And there's a sort of cartoon of some very sick-looking person going, "Don't worry, my doctor thinks my side effects are tolerable." And so it is tremendously important. I think this has been a fabulous conversation. I'm sure we could keep going on, but as I said, I feel like we're about to enter the kind of the golden age of the pharmacokineticist here in drug development. But also let's wrap this up with you. So you've got the two boys, you've got your hyper adventurous husband. So you've got lots of stuff to do at work with Project Optimus, but what is the next 5 years going to involve for you, both professionally and personally? Or what would you like it to involve?
Professionally, like I said, I think it's a hopeful time for our cancer patients where we're implementing all these new ideas into dose optimization. And we're just waiting for the results to read out and to actually approve drugs where we have a really good support for the dosages selected based on the totality of data approach that we're trying to include and promote the Project Optimus and other initiatives in oncology like Patient Voice, Project Patient Voice also at MMCE or the Office of Oncology Center of Excellence. So that's hopeful in terms of all the different molecularly targeted agents. It's a very exciting and hopeful time for cancer patients. Personally, in the next 5 years, obviously my kids will be getting ready to leave and have their own adventures in life. So I really probably realize that I'm going to be an empty nester. We've had some wonderful experiences exploring different interests with our kids and trying to make them well-rounded individuals to contribute positively to the world. So I think we would like to squeeze in a few more of these adventures with my husband. It's exciting to have, see your kids exploring different things. And recently, I think it's all they've always been interested in. We've always encouraged them to do different things and explore different things. But recently, it's been culminating in them just being successful in securing some positions in local orchestras or highly competitive orchestras that play to the public. We are able to just really enjoy seeing them excel at some of the passions that they've developed just by exploring different things in their lives and was enjoying sort of the benefits of having found the things that they love. They may not be all the things that they love in the future, but definitely identifying some of those things that make them happy and seeing that flourish.
Yeah, I think that's a great line to end on, because we've seen your passion for your family and your passion for your job and how hopefully it's making the rest of the world better as well. Joel, I can't thank you enough. Thank you so much. You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at Dr. Kamage on X for additional commentary.